And now it is actually my pleasure to hand off the program to Una Murphy, a designer at Levi Strauss & Company, to introduce the rest of the panel for this evening.
Hello and welcome to tonight's program, You Are What You Wear, Fashion Matters. The Commonwealth Clubs highlight some of today's most pressing issues, and at Levi Strauss & Company, sustainability is at the top of our list. I'm Una Murphy, and I'm a senior designer at Levi's. Part of my job revolves around how I, as a designer, can design sustainability into our products. How do I make design choices that put sustainability at the center? How can I innovate to reduce the environmental impact of our products without sacrificing the aesthetics? I believe that designing for durability and quality is one of the most sustainable things that I can do. At Levi Strauss & Company, quality is built into the DNA of our products. They're designed to be timeless and to last for decades, not just for one season. But that doesn't let a company like ours off the hook. Fashion matters because the apparel industry is an enormous industry and we all buy clothes. We need to understand the environmental impact of what we do and help to improve the lives of the people who are making our products. Tonight's panel, as it relates to sustainability and fashion, is going to be a great conversation. Please join me in welcoming our esteemed panelists, Patty Cazzato, the CEO of Timbuktu, Mike Nathanshon, the CEO of Marine Layer, Connie Ulowitz, a professor at San Francisco State, a researcher and author, and our moderator for the evening, Jason Kibbe, the CEO of the Sustainable Apparel Coalition.
Thank you again. Thank you to Levi's for sponsoring this program, and thank you to the Commonwealth Club, and a thank you to our panelists for volunteering their time tonight. I'm going to just start right off by jumping right in. Why are each of you here tonight? What about the subject of sustainability and fashion brought you to want to share your story with this audience? Patty, let's start with you.
I would say after being in the fashion industry for over 27 plus years, that it became much more important for me to be connected with a brand or a company that really believes in doing something better. And so when I heard about this, I actually just got back from Iceland last night, really late, so I thought I'm not going to do that. But it is important. It's important for us to kind of share our stories, and I am really proud to work for a company that has sustainability built into its core. And so I'm here to just kind of talk about the details of that.
Great, fantastic. Mike, how about yourself?
I'm here to learn a lot more about this topic. You know, I think it's excited to sort of share what we do at Marine Layer, and you know, it's something that we give a lot of thought to, but we're still a pretty new business, and I think that I'm excited to sort of come out of here with some new ideas and learn from companies that I admire. I'm excited to hear what Patty has to say at Timbuktu and see if we can put some of that to practice for us as well.
Fantastic. And Connie, how about yourself?
I'm here to share the good news.
Fantastic. So why don't we start with this good news? And Connie, maybe I'll start with you. You know, you're someone who actually has a great high-level view of what's going on. This is something that you study, you teach, and you research. What are you seeing? What are the macro trends that give you hope, and what are those that give you a little bit of concern?
What gives me a little bit of concern is when a customer asks one question about an item and says, is this organic cotton? And if it's organic cotton, that's like really good. We need to look at the entire picture. We need to ask many, many questions. That's what concerns me. The good thing is that we are asking questions and getting more information, and there is more transparency. We need to continue to ask that. And my role in this is to help individuals to understand that textiles have a value even after their first initial life. Textiles are important, textiles have a cost, and we're all involved with them.
And how is that getting better? And you started saying you want to share the good news. So what are you seeing that's encouraging?
Well, for example, with Levi Strauss and Goodwill and San Francisco State, we were able to connect and bring denim products to San Francisco State that for some reason, for many reasons, they could not be sold in their traditional stores. We were able to bring them to San Francisco State. We were able to bring sewing machines down onto the quad. We were able to remake these for people so that they could buy them and understand in the process of, it's not so difficult to sew a button. Those kind of things. So, yeah.
Fantastic. And Connie, you mentioned the questions that you get, and I'd love to maybe actually transition it to two of our apparel company CEOs. What are the questions that you're hearing about sustainability from your customers? What are they asking you? How are they engaging with you? And how are they holding you potentially even accountable? Maybe Connie? Sorry, Patty.
We always get where you manufactured and why. And so it's really interesting because we own and operate our own manufacturing, our own factory here in San Francisco in the Mission, which is close to impossible, as you all know, with today's prices. But we do. We have a 23,000 square foot factory. And so it's important to people when they come into our stores, our retail stores, or even our online customers, they ask a lot of questions about, is it made in the U.S.? Is it made in the U.S.? And so, you know, yes, if you buy a custom bag, it's made in the U.S., but we also manufacture in two factories outside of the U.S. So I think the number one question is, where is it manufactured and how long will it last? And so we offer a lifetime guarantee on our products, which we believe, just like Levi's, that you have to build quality products. I mean, at this day and age, like, fast fashion is just not us, you know, it's just really not our brand. And so we believe in repairing and recycling and, you know, reducing the waste and repurposing, just like Connie was talking about. And that's really important to our customers. And they'll come in and just say, I don't really want to break up with this bag, but I'm going to, and I need to make sure it's going to go to a good home. And so we do everything from repair it and donate it. And if it's beyond repair, which a lot of them are, because people have had them for sometimes over 25 years, we actually take them to TerraCycle and completely decompose them. So we have zero products that go to landfill, which is something we're really proud of. Yeah.
Fantastic.
It's good. It's good.
No, I was reminded of that longevity as I was backing out of my driveway. I was staring at a Timbuktu bag that I got in 1995.
Ooh.
I think when they were still made out of someone's garage. Mike, what about you? What are the conversations that you're having about your customers? You guys, I just learned, are 19 stores. You're in a lot of markets where consumers actually are really engaged on social and environmental issues. What are they asking you?
Well, we're just happy when they ask a question. You know, I mean, I think that's like the first thing is just we have a pretty good story to tell. And I think it's just paramount to get customers engaged, especially for sort of where we are, you know, selling predominantly T-shirts and tops, which are a little bit of a less considered purchase. So it's sort of like someone goes to dinner and they buy a T-shirt or they get a gift. It's not something that they're spending as much time as, jeans or a bag that you're going to, sort of commensurate with the price point a lot. So we're just happy when people ask where our stuff is made or, you know, about the fabric, because we don't use organic cotton, but the particular sort of our custom signature fabric is knit in a closed loop facility where the amount of water that we use when we're knitting all these goods is significantly lower than something like organic cotton. So I think there's a lot of, there's some opacity in the apparel industry, especially about how things are made. And I feel like the more that people are asking the questions, the more that, you know, people want to make good decisions. You know, I think everybody wants to help if they can, and the more information that we can provide, you know, I think.
And so one thing that I noticed when I was looking at the Marine Layer site, and I've experienced this myself from owning an apparel company, so you're not leading front and center with that story, and it's not something that is staring your customer in the face. And you guys have also had the fortune of building the company from the beginning. Why haven't you chosen to sort of tell that story more loudly when you do have something that's really you can be proud about? How do you see customer perceptions potentially being maybe even sometimes put off by the sustainability story?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I feel like for us, you know, coming from a business, you know, from nothing, making T-shirts in my house, you know, it was important to us for the business to survive, you know. And so I think what I've always said and say to everybody at our company is that we have to make the best possible product that we can, because that's going to ensure our success. And we just try and do that in a thoughtful, responsible way. So, you know, perhaps we could spend more time, you know, being visible about that. But I think ultimately for us, it's important to me that we're doing things the right way and, you know, let people, you know, people will find that if they want to.
Fantastic. So one of the things that we talked about before we started and is this issue, and Patty started to mention it, about Made in America, that somehow Made in America is much more sustainable. And both of you have chosen to make both in the United States and abroad. And in my experience, the worst factory I've ever seen still in my career is actually in San Francisco, where I saw boxes piled up literally to the ceiling, saw a place that if it caught fire, you know, people would probably die. And yet it's here it is in San Francisco. And there is this perception that Made in America is always the most sustainable, it's always the most just. And how have you sort of wrestled with these decisions as you've moved some things abroad and you continue to make in California? Would love to hear both of your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think, you know, it actually gets back to your last question too, where we started making things in the U.S. And sort of always said that our customer would tell us where they want us to make certain things. And, you know, the tipping point for us is something that we gave a lot of thought to when we moved some of our products overseas. We tried to make sweaters at what is essentially the last fully functional sweater production facility in the U.S. down in L.A. And the sweaters we made were about 40% more expensive than the ones we're currently making, and I would say 30% lower quality. You know, just bad seams, bad craftsmanship, and you know, we still have a lot of them. Nobody bought them. So I think that was something that, you know, for our t-shirts and, you know, our knits and our jersey, there's a thriving industry in LA, and that's over half of our business. So we're always going to do that in the U.S. For some of our more technical pieces like that, it's the craftsmanship and the quality of the product is a lot better overseas. And, you know, to me, it's a win if somebody has that sweater for 10 years and they don't throw it, you know, as opposed to maybe that first generation of sweaters that we bought and the seam starts to unravel after a year and a half. Like, you're measuring the impact there. It costs a little bit more to bring those over on a boat, but probably, you know, the overall sort of cost, and, you know, which is it's a tough thing to measure, but I feel like we're coming out on the right side of that if we make the best possible product.
And Patty, what's been your experience?
Some of it's very similar. So to build a quality product, a lot of it's capability. Mm-hmm. So if we don't have the capability here in the U.S., you have to take it to a factory that actually has the capability. But I think the way we made our decision was that we wanted to be in very few factories. I've worked for companies that have many factories, thousands of factories. But we decided it was more important for us to be in just 3 factories total, and to be one of the largest customers in that factory so that we could set the compliance. And that's really important. So we have someone from our office in our 2 factories overseas, at least about every 6 weeks. And so for us to set the compliance for the factory, it's run and operated exactly the same way we run and operate our factory here in the U.S. And it's really great because we can share our knowledge with our 2 factories that we work with. And they're more like partners. I mean, we call them our partners. They do, you know, they help us with a lot of things, and, you know, from anything from, you know, helping us with the inventory and holding on to it. I mean, things that other factories just would not do. But it's really important to know what's going on in the factories that you're in, no matter what. I mean, that's really, to me, I've worked and seen a lot of production and a lot of factories, and I've seen the good, the bad, and the ugly. And so, you know, the good, you just know when you see it, it's just the right, you just have to stay with the factories that are the best for your brand and your company.
So do you guys think that the most sustainable products,
I want to weigh in on that one, if I can, just because I don't want people in the audience to think that we have bad factories in San Francisco.
No.
We have good factories in San Francisco that are manufacturing. And also, it really depends on, again, not just looking at, as I was mentioning before, the organic cotton, but what is it that you are manufacturing? Because there are some people that manufacture in the Greater Bay Area, and their garments do last 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, 20 years. So it's part of the whole picture, if you will. And we do have factories that are producing good goods here. Just needed to say that.
Well, and that it is a spectrum, and I think yeah. you know, and I maybe I'll throw this back to all of you guys in terms of the future. There's a lot of discussion about closed loop manufacturing and about local manufacturing mm-hmm. and a shift towards, especially as we look at new technologies, 3D printing, much lower cost. Where do you see the future of local manufacturing as new technologies emerge, as there have been a new focus on product take back, long-term repair? Maybe start with you, Connie.
Well, it's what the word local means also. You know, if anybody, when you go home tonight and you look inside the labels of your garments and you try to see where your clothes are made, you don't have to say made in California. You need to have the country of origin, which is made in the United States. So is that local enough? And if we have more that's being made domestically in the United States, my reason for supporting that is because it supports jobs for people within the United States. And as I started out in the manufacturing industry, so I was working for firms and had my own collection also in the 80s and in the 90s, and we had more manufacturing going on then. So there was more people doing more, and now there are fewer people that are trying to build together. And I think that the manufacturing may not be in San Francisco. It may be in Newark. It may be in Novato. It may be in Des Moines. But that's what I mean by local.
How about you guys? I mean, Timbuktu especially has really, with your retail concepts, you guys have looked a lot at you know, using, bringing some of the repair and some of this into your stores. Yep. How do you see this as part of your future business model?
Oh, I think it's a huge piece of our business model. I mean, I think we're a global brand, right? So we, you know, we're selling around the world. And so for us, if we're building a quality product that has a lifetime guarantee, we have to make sure that, one, all the fabrics that we're using are highly tested, you know, that we are using things that are really going to last, not just, you know, that we think are going to last. So we do a lot of testing, which I haven't seen in many places. And then after that, we actually reward people to bring their products back to us. So it's part of our business model now, and I think in the future it's definitely going to become more of our business model. I think the things that will change are really like the parts, the components. I mean, things like that are really what I think, like when you're talking about 3D printing, and that's here based in the U.S. right now. I mean, the highest tech I've seen is right down, you know, 40 minutes away. But it's very interesting because I think so many things are changing so quickly. And so when I talked about capabilities, I meant what country has the capability to do the things that we need to do for the future. And so like all companies, we have to stay ahead of the curve and the trend. And right now, innovation labs are where it's at. And talking about for our customer, what's innovative for our customer? What are they going to want from us? What's going to be the product that they want to keep for a lifetime that is core to who we are as a brand, which is supporting bike culture, which is inherently, you know, we consider that inherently pretty sustainable to get on your bike at all times. So, you know, I think it's interesting. It's just really the way we look at it is just about, you know, kind of staying ahead of what's right for us. And it could be anything from parts to the fabrics to the way we manufacture. But yeah, absolutely. Repurposing and recycling is critical to our business right now and for the future.
And can you just share a little bit about the new retail models and how you guys are actually incorporating repair into the stores?
We have a whole life cycle center. So you're going to see we're going to open a large one at the end of this year at Shotwell. So we'll have our corporate headquarters, our factory, and our life cycle center attached to our store on 20th and Shotwell, which will be fun. But right now, if you go to Portland, that's our latest prototype, where you walk in and the store looks like a regular storefront at the front, but in the back, it's a whole homage to Rob Honeycutt, our founder, who was a bike messenger, and it's his workshop from 1989 with his real sewing machine, his cassette recording of his songs that he was listening to. His sketches are there. But what's really cool is that then it's a whole center of where you can kind of talk about, if this doesn't work for you new and you don't want to customize something that's new, we can take it back for you and we can repair it. And so the stores are all fully trained. And then we have an on-site sewer that actually does all the repairs, and a full-time person who does the processing and then gets it to the repairs center. So yeah, we have a pretty quick turnaround also. But I think that last year I was looking at the numbers. We repaired 15,000 bags last year. Woo. We're not a big company. I mean, we're a company, but we're not huge, and we repaired 15,000 bags. So I think it's great. People really want There's something also about, it's a little bit like your Levi's. If you have your favorite pair of Levi's or your favorite Timbuktu bag, you want to hold on to it. And so it has some story and it has your story with it. And so we always ask people, do you want to get rid of it? And they're like, nope. Repair that baby. I'm like, okay, we'll do our best. But it's, yeah, I mean, like your bag. We can fix that up for you if you want.
It doesn't even need repair. It was made that well. Yeah, so let's talk a little bit about longevity. And this is actually one of the things that we found in our research is that longevity really, and being able to give multiple lives to a product, that is really in some ways something to make it the most sustainable. Love to hear about anything, Connie, that you're seeing out in the marketplace that you're finding particularly inspiring. Or Mike, if there's anything that you wanted to add about things that you're looking at about either designing for longevity or timeless style, either feel free to jump in.
I think that it's a particularly challenging problem for us because one of the core things that people buy into our brand for is the softness of our shirts, and there's an inherent trade-off between softness and durability. And we can make a Hanes like 7-ounce terribly uncomfortable t-shirt that's going to last for an incredible amount of time, but what our product what our customers want from us is sort of a very soft, more delicate shirt. So what we really try and focus on, and we spent a lot of time thinking about how can we repurpose t-shirts, and we have these, there's this like terrible looking like bag. It looks like a purse that we tried to make from like all these old t-shirts, and it's just like, that's, there's some things that we hold it up in our office all the time because it was like, I think it was a noble effort. We were trying to think, all right, we're getting, when we get fabric back that, or, the odd lots of fabric and things like that. And it's really hard to, we haven't yet been able to make that work. And so where we spend a lot of our time is just, kind of what Patty was saying about finding the best place that can make, the best possible fabric that's just going to last longer for one use. For our price point and what we're making, the best possible thing that I think we could do is make a t-shirt that you keep for 10 years. And then, we'll pass it along to somewhere else for you after that. But that's really where I think moves the needle the most for us.
Now, and the LCA research, life cycle assessment research, actually holds that up, that is the way to make the least impact with a garment. Connie, anything that you're seeing in the marketplace or that's really inspiring or innovative to you?
The students I deal with every day at San Francisco State are exciting to me in what we're dealing with. So it could be that as a product development instructor, what I'm doing is working with the hotel industry and getting tablecloths that are stained and the stains can't come out and they are going to discard them, and I like take them from them and I give them to our students and I say, what can you do with this? And they recreate product out of that, whether it's a dress that they would wear or a jacket that they would wear, or someone made dog coats and printed places in the city to take dog parks to take. So, or the same thing when I was, again, the product with Levi Strauss. It's giving someone, throwing someone a pair of jeans and say, what can you do with it? And seeing what people can do with it. Because it's not creating with one intent, but it's looking at this as a value structure and what can I do with it again and again and again. And when I'm finished with this pocket, could that pocket be on the outside of a jacket that I have or on the outside of a bag that I have? So it's also instructing people in a way that they enlighten me as to new ways of creating product. And then when you all employ them, that they bring those ideas to their next place of being.
So one of the things that is the biggest challenge often of sustainability is making it a sustainable business model and actually making it work from a business case. This is something I work with many very large companies. This is always the challenge when you're talking to CEOs. But it also comes down to newer companies like Marine Layer or more established companies like Timbuktu, who I think you're in your third round of owners, who also you have to make a return on investment. How have you guys weighed the business model? And Connie, feel free to chime in about any examples that you've come close to. How do you see this trade-off, and how do you actually make sustainability sustainable from a business perspective, and how have you thought about it in your companies?
Well, I think the biggest factor is that, we're really committed. I would say that when companies talk about their higher purpose or the why, or however you want to frame it, is that we have a really big commitment to what we say, better products, better cities, better communities. And so the better cities part for us is really being true to this urban manufacturing and staying in the mission. And, you know, what we have is we, you know, walk from our desks and we walk into our factory and we are paying people really great livable wages with really great benefits. So the sewers have the exact same benefits that I have. And, you know, for us, when you think about sustainability, it's the people side of it as much as it is the, you know, the earth side of it, which is really important on both sides. But for us, we really try to build a company that everybody wants to work for and that we're offering them a way to live in their own communities and be a part and be vibrant and be a part of the city and not have to commute in 2 hours, you know, to be here. And so I think that plays a part in sustainability, you know,
being. And is that actually from a bottom line? Is that helping? Are you able to retain workers, or is that a struggle?
The average tenure of our sewers is 16 years. So I would say it definitely is a retention strategy. And it's funny because every time a job may open, we're actually expanding our factory this year as well. But every time a job opens, it can never get posted. It has to go to a friend of a friend because they all really like working there. I think definitely from retention. And it's also just, you know, it's a feel-good thing too, right? Anybody that works there, if you're not even on, you know, the factory side, you know, we have a few people in the audience today, but it's a feel-good thing. Like, we all are really proud to work there. You know, it's a pride. It gives us a lot of pride.
Mike, how about you? For you, how do you find this balance? I mean, you obviously have had to be sustainable in order to grow and survive, and which is very tough as a young apparel company. So how have you thought about this and the trade-offs that you maybe have had to do over the last several years?
Yeah, I think there's something about sort of being a small startup that keeps you honest. You know, I think that in some ways it's really hard because we don't have the resources of a more established company, but we also don't have any business practices that are already getting us into trouble that are hard to change, you know. So we had to start from scratch, and I think we, you know, always kind of, all right, we have to make a great product. Let's do it in a way that feels responsible, and sort of from there, it's very organically driven. And I think that, you know, having a successful business has led to a lot of other sort of not side effects, but, you know, we employ probably 50 or 60 different factory workers around San Francisco and down in LA. And, you know, we support some communities overseas that I'm very proud to work with as well. I mean, one of the things my business partner and I, when we were looking to move some of our production overseas, we took a trip over there, and, you know, I thought it was really enlightening and wonderful to meet different partners in other parts of the world that were trying to do their part. And, you know, there's a really strong entrepreneurial spirit in China that I think our customers aren't always aware of. And, you know, they're, you know, really wanted to partner with us, and our success is begetting their success. You know, it's like if we pick the right factory that's, you know, doing things the right way, the way that Patty talks about, you know, which is why I went over there. And you could tell, you know, there's good partners and bad partners everywhere you go. But if you pick a good one and your business grows, then, you know, we are supporting a factory that employs 50 people with ethical standards overseas and, you know, in LA as well. So I think that's been a nice bonus.
Connie, any businesses that you want to hold up as other examples of ones that do well and do good at the same time?
Well, I would again go back to, I'm obligated to work with the students that I work with and teach with to have them understand why something might cost a certain amount of money. So we have to teach a costing model, and if you were making that in San Francisco, what you would be paying at, or what we're at 14, what, an hour now? $14, who knows what you're being paid in San Francisco now? $14 and $15 an hour? We can tell we're not hourly wage people in this room. It's $15 an hour. Okay, and so if you were making that here, that's what you would be paying for it. So again, a model that I have is that we are the tablecloths I was telling you about. We are manufacturing bags in the city of San Francisco out of those. These are the same bags that you might buy at Trader Joe's or Whole Foods for 99 cents. Well, it costs $4.50 first cost just to sew the bag here because of what we're paying for people. You're buying a bag for $1.29. Well, if we value the textile itself, it had a previous life. It's going to go to landfill. We can do this with it, and then it won't go there. Ah, okay. then I'll pay more for that because I understand the value of that. I think someone in San Francisco doesn't produce everything in San Francisco, but a company that's doing a very good job is Everlane. Everlane is, their transparency is that you go on that website and they tell you the factories, show you the factories, show you the fabric. The other thing I should say, just if I can,
please,
is that when I was saying made in and look at your labels, that's made in where your garment was construction. You have no idea where the cotton was grown, where the yarn was spun, where it was knitted or woven into a fabric, because we haven't asked the questions. So we have to ask the questions. People will give us the information. Everlane's a perfect example of that, with transparency and the supply chain management you were talking about.
I don't want to say anything too inflammatory here, but I think Everlane does a great job of marketing their transparency. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, what's interesting, though, is at the end of the day, they're a price-cutting strategy. You know, they're trying to, you know, they're a discount-driven brand, and, you know, there's a lot of their products that I don't think last very long. So, you know, I think on one hand, they're doing something really mm-hmm. good about showing where they get things, and mm-hmm. it's very well marketed, and I think the customer feels that. It's interesting from my standpoint inside the industry and sort of understanding quality and products and sort of like, all right, you made that shirt dramatically less expensive than, you know, something that we sell, and for a year it's going to be fine, but that's probably it. And, you know, that's a less discussed part of that piece.
Good to see some founder's pride, Patty.
I was just going to say that transparency is new, right? Because I would say what I've noticed over the long haul that I've been in this industry is that we all used to be competitors. And now I feel like we're collaborators, and especially the people that care about sustainability. There really is a common language, and it's interesting to watch how transparent people are becoming. And, you know, we'll probably have a conversation tomorrow, and we'll probably tell each other everything about our business. And that never went on 20 years ago. We would never show our hand to anyone. And if you go to outdoor retailer like we do, we show at outdoor retailer twice a year, and you go there and everybody's, you know, sharing secrets and sharing factories and sharing information and how to get the best fabrics and how to get Blue Sign and do this and do that. And it's really interesting because I think that is, for me, what is the next way for us to get sustainability to really kind of take hold in the fashion industry is for us all to kind of share what we know and what we're doing well so that we can, you know, use that and other people can use it. It's very different than 20 years ago where nobody would share any information. You don't share your intel usually, but it's new.
I can say with certainty that's coming soon. Mm-hmm. That is a lot of the work that we do with the Sustainable Apparel Coalition. We have something called the Higg Index, and that our membership committed to actually rolling it out publicly in the next 3 to 5 years. So you're going to see transparency of factories, transparency of products, and transparency of brands. So I'm going to maybe take a darker turn for this because we've talked good vibes. But this is a really messy industry. This is an industry that has 10% of the global carbon emissions. It's the second largest carbon polluter, only after the oil and gas industry. 20% of the world's industrial water pollution actually comes from textile dyeing and finishing. 60 to 70 million people are employed in it, predominantly women, mostly barely above poverty. And it produces 80 billion pieces a year. This is an enormous impact. So I maybe want to ask, you know, given that this is a somewhat dark and grim industry that is in need of systemic change, and here we are in San Francisco with leaders and people that are from a place that often thinks about how do we change it. How do you see your role in actually being a part of some of the systemic change for a system that, you know, I think all of us acknowledge is broken?
Go for it. Buy less stuff. I mean, at the end of the day, you know, buy better quality, buy less things, and make sure that you know, what you buy is really important to you. I mean, I just got back from Scandinavia, and it was pretty amazing. They have everything they need, but it's sparse, right? They don't have a lot of stuff. They're not like Americans. they have all the right stuff and all the right amount of things in the right places, and they have beautiful, like, compost and recycling and trash bins everywhere. And so, you know, I think what's different about the way they do it is they buy less and they buy better quality and it lasts and it's, you know, something that there's not a lot of waste. They don't have a lot of things to throw away every week, you know. So I think it's more about just making better decisions. And
how does Timbuktu see itself as a part of that? I know you have somewhat activist owners.
Absolutely.
And so you know, that's obviously part of your DNA. Yeah. But how are you actually seeing, you know, you guys obviously talk about this in your board meetings as being a part of the change. So without necessarily sharing any secrets, but how do you actually see this as part of your strategy, as part of your mission?
I think it's really lifetime warranty. I think that is really how we publicly offer our mission to people, is that we say, no matter what, and we really have, we really have done bags from 25 years ago. I'm not kidding when I say that. But no matter what, we stand behind our product, no matter what. And we'll fix it, we'll repair it, we'll recycle it, we'll do whatever you want. We'll get you something new, and then we'll give it to somebody else if that's what we need to do. And even to Connie's point, the TerraCycle program that we use to, you know, we pay to have our bags decomposed and not to go to landfill. So that's something that we do internally. But we also upcycle with TerraCycle. So what's interesting is that they sent us thousands of yards of U.S. postal bags, and we cut them all up and turned them into, you know, messenger bags or backpacks. And it was one of our best sellers. It was just really funny. But when you said tablecloths, I'm like, oh yeah, those mail bags we did a few years ago. So I think there's just a lot of this that goes on, that the future it'll just be more natural. It'll just go on with, I think, it throughout every industry.
And Mike, you have a brand that, you know, I'd say celebrates a relaxed California style and good times. You look at your images and it feels good. But, and we are in this industry that's kind of dark sometimes. How do you see yourselves as contributing to the larger change?
I think it's a great question, and it speaks well to sort of where we sit in the market and some of the challenges that we face. And I think one of the things that Patty said about collaboration and sharing is really important. And I feel like the only thing that I would annotate there is that it's really, you know, a bunch of small innovative brands sharing, you know, it's like a bunch of Davids versus Goliath. Cause I think, you know, I'm not talking to Zara about where they manufacture their shirts for $2 and, you know, someplace that I would never want to go to. And I think that that's something that, is interesting, where it's like, because I think the darkness, and you know, you talk about Scandinavia versus America, and that this fast fashion is sort of built around that consumerism culture. And it's just like, and it's really hard to combat that, because you can, you know, there's somebody running the calculus saying that, okay, you know, we can make this shirt if we make 50,000 of them for this dramatically lower cost. And it doesn't matter if it lasts more than a year, because somebody's going to buy it this year, and then they're going to buy something again next year because they can get the prices down so low. So I feel like really like the brands and the smaller companies sort of collaborating together is a great way to sort of build awareness and again, I think educate the customer and also create cool products. Like at the end of the day, you know, the bag that you're talking about there is a cool, well done product, you know, and the customer rewards that, you know, if you made it and it looked like our little sustainable bag attempt, you know, it would not work.
We can help you with that.
Yeah, we need some help.
I see a collaboration coming up.
Yeah. Collab.
And Connie, what about you as an educator? You know, how do you see yourself as part of, you know, contributing to this systemic improvement of this messy industry?
Well, what we need to understand is that each one of us are part of the industry, because each one of us are consumers. So that's what we're working with our students all the time. It's the choices we make or the choices we don't make, and the information we ask for, or the information that we say, oh, I don't really need to know. So it is a lousy industry in many ways. I mean, we talk about pollution, just because the latest color that we need to buy is bright orange or bright yellow, and what it's going to be doing to polluting the waters in China and people that are manufacturing there. You can see all the dyes that are running off in the waters there. Well, why did we need that orange or purple or whatever the color might be to begin with? So who holds the responsibility? The consumer asking for it or the manufacturer giving them? And it's a connection that we have to maintain and think about at all times. So the other question I ask, and I know you have a wonderful cotton shirt, but cotton as a fiber takes water and takes land. In the state of California, where are we with water? Is cotton a crop that we should be growing here? I mean, we have some really hard questions and decisions to look at and to ask ourselves and to ask others. Let's start asking.
So that's a good transition. I want to maybe, as we before we go into questions, talk about the consumers and talk about how. Well, I'm sure a lot of people in this audience are people that are you know, we all buy clothes. Everyone here buys clothes. How should consumers engage in a way that holds brands accountable, holds themselves accountable, and actually changes the dialogue? I mean, what you guys are CEOs, you've received letters, you've had conversations with your customers. What's actually changed the way that you've thought about things, or what are innovative ways that you think consumers can actually help change the dialogue?
Consumers are funny, right? I think that I don't think it's that different than what we're going through with the food movement, right? I mean, you know, we were discussing this. It's like if you understand the difference between conventional and organic, and you really understand it, right? You really, really process it and understand it, you're going to all of a sudden go into Whole Foods and say, it's not okay that you carry conventional and organic. I want to vote with my dollars that I want only the organic. And so I think we're going to start to see shifts. And I have seen shifts like that. When I had my own company, it was an eco-sustainable company here in San Francisco. And people, you know, in 2008, when the credit markets crashed, I had two customers separate come in and say, here's $500, just spend it anyway, buy gifts for me because I don't want you to go out of business because I believe in your mission. And so those two customers voted with their dollars. And it's the only thing that consumers can do. They can ask the questions, like Connie was saying, they can start asking the right questions. They can really do their research because anybody can say they're green or eco or this or that. Trust me, anyone can say it. And they do say it, and it's just like the whole greenwashing thing. But if people really dig in and start to understand the companies, like our customers attracted to our brand because they know our story. We never start off with, can we sell you a bag? There's not one person in my store or e-com that would say that. We start off with our story. And so I think people get educated just like they're getting educated on food. I think it's going to start to change.
Yeah, I think that, there was a bit of a blank stare when you asked that question. And it wasn't because, I don't know, I think about it much more in terms of like what the onus is on for me and for my company. And, you know, we just try and make it as easy as we can for the customer to sort of make good decisions. And I think that's what Patty is talking about in terms of, you know, customers vote, you know, they're the most free market part of this process. And I think what we try and do is just make it a little bit easier for them to make a good decision, you know, because I think by and large, people want to, you know, they don't necessarily want to if, you know, the price of the sustainable shirt is four times the price of, you know, something else. Like there's other realities that people have to consider. And, you know, I think part of this, you know, fast fashion and things that we look at there, it's like customers can sense value. Well, you know, and a lot of people are, you know, one of the things that's been nice about being in San Francisco is like the economy is doing quite well. So it enables, you know, some things that, you know, people are more comfortable spending a little bit more now and investing in a longer term value. But that's a tough proposition when, you know, if someone doesn't, you know, if they're making minimum wage or something like that, it's a harder question to ask. So I think that's where the onus comes back to the company and saying, all right, how can we make this as, you know, value conscious as possible?
Connie, do you want to add anything?
Yeah. Do you remember when we did not have cans for recycling of glass and paper and all? Okay. So look at your textiles. Do you have a little bin that you can put your textile products in? Is there anything on the label that has a triangle with a number inside of it like we have for other? Well, why not? 4% of the waste in the city of San Francisco is textile waste. The city of San Francisco is claiming or really wanting to be zero waste by 2020. Unless each one of us in this room starts thinking about what to do with those products and gets that information, we won't be able to meet that goal. So it's the sharing of information again and helping each other of understanding, well, where should I put that that textile. And I am here to tell you, for those people that think if you only have one sock, you can't give that one sock to Goodwill, you can. And you can give your underwear to Goodwill. Goodwill has a sorting process, so all of that is okay.
Great. So in 5 minutes, we will be taking questions, and I believe we'll be lining up over there. So if you do have questions for the panelists, if you want to start lining up, this would be a good time to do it. The microphone is right over there. But maybe before we go into questions, want to ask, you know, what gives you guys hope? Where do you think this is going, and what actually inspires you about, you know, why you believe that this industry and your companies can be really a force for good over the coming years?
I think the just the idea of innovation and creativity that's going on in sort of smaller businesses gives me hope that you can find solutions that solve a lot of problems at once. You know, we talk about Patagonia a lot as a triple bottom line, you know, and the three pillars of sustainability and, you know, environment and social equity. And I think that just, you know, putting some economic mind share behind it and businesses, you know, working to solve this problem and also create great products, it's like a nice, it gives me hope that, you know, you can sort of solve both things at once.
I mean, I think the fashion business by nature is a trend business and spotting trends. And so if we're not the industry that can see that it's a problem before anybody else, you know, we should also be the industry that kind of tries to solve the problem before it gets completely out of hand. So I get hope from that. And I get hope that, you know, other companies, like we were saying, can just learn from each other and do the right thing and understand, like, oh, that's a great idea, I'm going to adopt that. But I also really feel strongly that every head of every business should be putting it into the culture of their company. I mean, I have a funny story where there's a marketing manager and she runs to the factory every day and checks the recycling bin to see how many scraps we have in the recycling bin. I'm like, enough, that's not your job. Get out of the recycling bin. And she's militant, right? And it's so funny because since she's been doing that, it's gone from, like, you know, this much of a pile to nothing. And so I just think it's every person plays a part, you know, no matter what your job is, it doesn't matter. But if it's part of the culture, things will start to shift.
Connie?
I have hope because it's Tuesday night and you filled this room and there's a line of people with questions. Uh-huh.
So why don't we actually transition over to the questions? So just one note that we really do want to have questions, not long statements. And I will try to impersonate my best Michael Krasny and turn your statement into a question if you continue on. But we'll just go ahead and ask any questions to our panelists, please.
Okay. My name is Judy, and I'm the owner of Mannequin Madness in Oakland. We recycle mannequins. And I just wanted to mention that most of the time we talk about sustainability in terms of the production of items, but not so much the merchandising of items. There's a lot of waste that happens with display fixtures, how the items are displayed in the store. Rarely do you see repurposed items or recycled mannequins or mannequins that can be broken down. And that's a big part of the waste, too, that happens in the retail industry. So is there any conversation about the merchandising?
So maybe just upstream, what are some of the other impacts that you guys see or think about?
That's a great call out, and I think you know, we use old scaffolding boards for all of our shelves, which is something that, you know, we like the look of them, and they're, you know, it's a great way to just sort of get, you know, we've been able to get them very easily from people that are either throwing them away or doing something else with them, and, you know, I think good to know that there's a place where we could put our mannequins, you know.
Yeah. We try to support that also. We had a master student that did a project. She was a visual merchandiser at one of the large department stores in town. And that foam core, that, you know, anytime something, foam core comes down, foam core comes up, and foam core is one of the worst materials you can use. So, again, she created different visual merchandising for them, and they did make a change from
Perfect.
That. So we
Great.
Are trying
Glad to...
Glad to
see more examples of
Correct.
That.
Correct, yeah.
Okay. Great, thank you.
Yeah.
Hello. So we've been talking about voting with our dollar, and I think we all relate to it, but the fact that we're all here, it means that we care about it, and I don't think we're representative at all of this is like a 90% of people who really don't care. So how do you change the behavior of those who do not really care or who cannot afford to care?
Because you go out and tweet about it tonight. And they tweet about it, and they tweet about it, and then it goes on Instagram, and then everything that you've learned here.
This is one maybe I will also chime in. I think this is a problem for the world right now, that everyone is trying to figure out how are we going to make a change. Because if we look at sustainability spending or responsible spending, it's typically only about 2 to 5% of the spending worldwide in any category. I think one thing that our work, the Apparel Coalition, that we're trying to do is we're trying to figure out different ways to engage people. And I think we are working under the assumption that the next generation and all the data that we see about millennials is that they actually do care, and that we're over the baby boomers, we're kind of over my generation, the Gen X, in terms of actually following through. But there's a huge amount of hope for this next generation. And I don't think we've figured out how to talk to them yet, but I think there's a very active conversation amongst all of the brands in the world looking to see how do you innovate to share this story in a way that makes everybody care. And it might look differently than people think. What we see a lot of the work that is coming up is that it might not be that people are looking for the absolute most sustainable answer, but they don't want to be part of a really bad problem. They don't want to be buying from companies that are sourcing in the worst factories in the world. And that has a huge amount of impact, even if it's not necessarily as optimistic as pushing up the top. Pulling up the bottom can often change the world in a much bigger way.
So we spoke briefly about, you know, the destination in terms of where the fabric's coming from, the material that's being used, the merchandising. What about the transportation? How does the transportation fall into the equation of finding sustainable clothing and then kind of delivering that to the consumer?
What a wonderful question.
I can actually know a little bit about this. If you do a life cycle assessment of clothing, unless it's being air freighted, the transportation is quite small. It's typically about 5 to 7% of the total impact. Big exception, though, if it's air freighted. And that's often a challenge for small companies that don't have much cash. But you know, the materials are really the biggest impact. Often estimated 50-60% of the impact is coming from the materials. And then depending on the product, Levi's is here, it also can be in the use phase. That can be a huge, huge impact actually using it. Transportation, though, it's not quite like food because you put it on these slow freighters and it tends to be smaller. I don't know. Do you guys have any, has this been something that you've looked at or worked with?
Yeah, I think speed is a big key there. And I think we've sort of had to consciously try not to chase trends too hard because that's, you know, it's the air versus boat. If you're putting stuff over on a boat and, you know, you're not trying to chase something and, you know, get and land a product in 3 or 4 weeks, if you're being a little bit more thoughtful about how you make it and how you plan, then that seems to be, that's the way that we address it.
And also you can address it by local. So as you know, if you're a global brand, you can start to look at, well, if I have a lot of my business, a lot of our emerging business is coming out of Japan. So, you know, it's smarter for us to be shipping Asia to Asia. So you just have to look at it a little bit more holistically, but I definitely agree with, you know, the transportation, as long as you stay away from air freight, which, you know, that's the big X. You don't want to ship your goods via air. Yeah.
Yeah, trucking can also be heavy. I mean, the boat is very low impact, but if you're driving something around the United States 2 or 3 times, it can be a heavy impact. Thank you.
Okay, thanks.
Hello. So my question is about the waste stream and tapping into the waste stream. And so, Patty, you discussed using the mail bags and Connie about the tablecloths. So I was wondering, what about the using the waste stream made it a one-time production that you're not able to recreate?
Oh, ours we just ran out of fabric. So we used all the mail bags. So it's really things like sometimes we'll get like military surplus stuff, you know, like old tents from the military. We'll just use it until it's gone. So we buy what we take it off their hands. We buy the fabric from them and then we use it. And when it's gone, then, you know, we just wait till the next thing comes along from TerraCycle. They're our only resource right now.
Connie, do you want to talk a little bit about just reuse in general? And I think that that's something that I think would be of interest to everyone.
Yeah, it's not something that, you know, we teach. So even the rare incidences where there's a home economics or a sewing class in the Greater Bay Area, we tend to teach from you know, you lay out a piece of fabric and you cut it up and you have what you want. We don't tend to teach how to deconstruct. And if we start thinking about deconstruction to reconstruct, that would get into some of that, because it would kind of be in our learning process that as we're growing up, we deconstruct and we reconstruct. And that's just the way it is. You don't just take that jacket and just throw it out. Whew. You know? So that's what I would say.
Thank you.
Hi. I was glad to hear that you guys pointed out that one of the ways that we can be most sustainable is to buy less stuff. And what I'm wondering is given that we live in a capitalist society where, you know, brands need to and companies need to meet financial goals, and there's this sort of rush for growth, do you think it's possible for brands to accept or be okay with this idea that they would make less money? Because, you know, right now I'm thinking specifically of there's, you know, a Business of Fashion article that came out in the last week that was lamenting the slow growth of fashion, you know, post-recession, and how, oh my God, we're not growing fast enough, we need to do more. Is it even possible for the fashion industry to accept that consumers might buy less of their stuff and make them less money?
As maybe the only person who runs an industry association that works on this, I think every company of scale right now is wrestling with this issue. That we're starting to see conversations about fundamental changes of business models. We're seeing massive research into circular economy. Right now, 4 years ago, we commissioned a study to look to see what types of circular technologies were available to actually take these things and repurpose them, rebuild them. And ultimately, it would be producing less new stuff. And now the vast majority of those technologies that were in labs or were just at testing scales are now in the marketplace. So I think that if we look honestly, that many of the largest companies are already wrestling with this. They're reconsidering some of their fundamental business models, and that it's difficult to talk about. But you are seeing it when in conversations about, you know, what are we and what are we building. You're seeing every large company that's, you know, $10, $20 billion company is having this conversation right now.
Thank you.
I think it also just starts with the consumer, right? Like if customers care about it, then businesses will follow. And, you know, I think the initial onus on a business, in my mind, is to make it easier for the customer to care. But, you know, as long as the customer cares, then we'll react and respond to that. And, you know, if people want to know where their stuff is coming from, then they're going to start going to the places where they can see that transparency and where they're supporting something that's, you know, ethically sourcing their goods. So hopefully customers, you know, keep caring about that. And I think what Connie is saying is, you know, the more that we talk about this stuff on a Tuesday night, the better that mm-hmm. just like puts it out there. And, you know,
yeah, and if you hold Patagonia as the gold standard, a lot of us do, you know, that they haven't really seen a decline in sales. You know, it's really, they've had growth. So I think there's ways of doing it. I think at some point we'll see who survives, right? I mean, eventually some people will just get weeded out.
And there are fundamental resource constraints. I think if we look at, you know, we often tend to think of clothing and fashion as just a North American, European issue, but you know, there are hundreds of millions of new consumers that are entering the marketplace, and we're not going to have the same number of resources to be able to serve them. Please.
Okay. As a consumer, I've definitely dug into different companies on a, you know, one-by-one basis, and I know you've mentioned things like Blue Sign or the Higg Index and that kind of thing, but is there any standard, something similar to maybe like Energy Star and other industries that would point us towards more eco-sustainable or humanitarian companies?
No, this is what we're trying to build. Yeah, I mean, there's that. That's why we exist. I mean, there are 120 different certifications in the apparel and footwear industry. The comparability is very difficult. You're going to see over the next 3 to 5 years a massive investment to make sure that this information is available worldwide to all consumers. So it's coming, but it's not coming soon enough.
Thank Thank you. Let's build it.
Yeah, and you know, it is like in the food industry, as someone had mentioned before, that we're following that in terms of still with that industry, what is it that, what does organic food, what does that mean, and who is certifying that? So there's hope.
Hey guys, thanks for being here. This is great. I think you have a whole room and more of people who are sitting on the edge of their seats wondering what can they be doing. And I think that, you know, understanding what to do with your textiles, you know, 4% is wasted every year in San Francisco. What specifically can we be doing with our money? Like, what should we be buying? Should we be buying hemp?
Sure. It's a great idea.
What else?
Timbuktu, marine layer.
Right.
Shameless plug.
I think from a it's your enthusiasm for asking the question is part of it. It's understanding that you're a part of the story and that you're just as much of a player as we are within this. So it's before you buy, it's asking the question, well, where did this cotton come from? Where was it grown? Well, I don't know. Well, could you find out for me? I mean, and then you'd have more information so that the more that people ask and the more that we're told, that's huge.
So there's not maybe like several things that are kind of safe to put your dollar behind?
No. Sorry, dear.
Not yet.
No. No, the most beautiful organic cotton t-shirt could be made by bonded labor. You know, it's really difficult, and that's why there's a need for holistic standards.
Actually, there is something that you can do. There's something that we all can do. It's not in the buying, it's in the washing and caring. And that is something. In terms of the amount of water that is wasted, it's because we tend to, you know, throw things in the wash because there's a little stain instead of taking the cloth and putting some water and soap or whatever and taking that off. So it's the washing, and then it's throwing it in the dryer for an hour when it really only needed 15 minutes or you could hang dry. Those are things that we can do that save the life of the product.
And
so...
We have time for just one more question here. I want to just add one other thing. Write to the companies that you shop from and tell them why you're buying more or why you're not buying any more. And I can tell you, I hear from sustainability managers and even CEOs all the time that that's the most impactful thing that happens. So if you're not going to shop somewhere, tell them why. And if you love a company, tell them why as well. That changes the companies more than you can ever imagine. So we'll take one last question.
Hi, my name's Aisha, and I'm the founder of Remake. We were actually funded by the Levi Strauss Foundation to educate millennials on ethical fashion. And I'll tell you, from a practical standpoint, it is very hard. And so, you talk a lot about buying less stuff. That might be a conversation that's great in the context of San Francisco. You look at New York Fashion Week, not a single ethical brand was in the lineup. You look at sort of where the industry is headed, it's in the exact opposite. And a lot of the ideas you've shared here are putting the onus on the customer, who's getting a lot of mixed messaging, right? You talk about Everlane, it's like, great, they put beautiful photos of their factories on their website, but actually they use third-party monitors and there've been scandals in their factories, and why should I trust a brand? So my question to you, there's actually a question here, is what are you all doing as industry leaders to make it easy for all of us walking out of this room to become ethical consumers beyond buying less stuff?
Well, I mean, I think it's back to transparency, right? Like I think you need to make sure that every company that you are purchasing from is transparent. And so do you believe in the story that they're telling you? And then that's really important. So, for us, saying that we own our own factory, it's in San Francisco. We give tours of our factory. You can come and see your bag being made if you would like. I mean, to me, that's a really great story, all the way down to you can go and watch it on the line if you'd like to see it. So there's something about that that's really real and authentic. And so I think every company just has to own their part. That's what I believe. I think everybody has to own their part. If you're going to run a company, you got to own your piece. And every employee that works in your company has, to believe in what you're doing and be part of the mission.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think that, when we made the decision to move some stuff overseas, like, we were very open about it. I think there was a lot of sort of internal struggle where it's like, how is this going to be received? And it was just like, we put a lot of thought into this decision. If you disagree with me, fine, we can talk about it. But, you know, all of our tags say where we make stuff, and, you know, we have a factories page where you can provide that, you know, information for them. And I think, you know, all we could do is put some thought in what we're doing and then be open about it and let the customer sort of inform their decision.
We have 10 people working in San Francisco, 5 in Amsterdam, 4 in Asia, all trying to create a universal standard for communicating sustainability. So I think it's going to happen. I'm very encouraged with the support. 40% of the industry is behind it. And it's going to take some time, but it will hopefully really change this industry. And with that, I need
read
to...
the label.
Oh, please. Fantastic.
Most people don't read the label. It's some information is there. You know, but not all. I appreciate that it's not all there, but if it's not there, then do what we were just told to do and write the question to the company and ask for that information.
Can I give you a more radical idea than that?
The last one, because we have to wrap up.
Okay. But, you know, we talk a lot, again, it's about read the label. Okay, it was made in Cambodia. There's some green factories in Cambodia. There's some sweatshops. I don't know what to do. I think it's about influencing culture. It's about celebrities and models and what's on the red carpet and what do we see on our television. You know, Beyonce just came out with Park Ivy. I saw her in a concert last night. It's like, where was that made? Turns out it might be in a sweatshop. All of you can tweet and ask her, where was it made? Mm-hmm. So I think the transparency has to go
well,
both
I like
ways.
That.
Fantastic. Yeah. So with that, I'm going to ask each of our panelists to, before you clap, give us one 60-second idea for, you know, changing the world. What is your 60-second idea for changing the world in this world of apparel and fashion?
Do I get to go first?
Or Connie, we'll switch the order. Connie, do you want to go first?
Sure. So my 60-second idea is to know that you are part of this industry because you are wearing clothing in this industry, and that sometime this year you sew on that button or you hem that pair of pants or you take the towel and wash the stain off of it so you make that garment reusable for you just once.
Mike?
Yeah, I think to that end, you know, my 60-second thought is just the role that my company plays in that. And we just want to make it a little bit easier for the customer to make some good decisions. And I think, you know, we're 20 or 30 people in our office and we can do so much, but, you know, we have a couple hundred thousand customers. And if we can, you know, set in some program that just makes it that much easier for them to keep their shirt a few more years, then that's a pretty powerful, larger change. So,
and I would say that just supporting the companies that really have meaning to you, because there's a lot of companies to choose from. And for me, just, I feel so much better when I make the right choices. And so, just, you know, being present and understanding what's going on and being careful and making the right choices, I think is really important. And we can all own that. So I think that would be something that seems pretty easy for all of us to do.
And as fantastic.
Yep.
So with that, give our panel a round of applause.
Nice job.
So, and please, a special thank you again to Levi for sponsoring this. And please do stick around for our post-program reception. All of the panelists will be walking out to the reception afterwards. And so if you're trying to pin any of them down on their way to get a drink, they will keep walking. You can pin them down in the reception area. But please, again, continue the conversation in the reception. Thank you.